Let me start with a takedown notice and the strangest reply to one I've read in a while. There's an open source project called Heretic, run by a developer named Philip Emmanuel Weidman. What Heretic does is automate something the local model crowd calls obliteration. You point it at an open weight model, and it finds the directions inside the model's activations that correspond to refusal, the thing that makes it say, "I can't help with that," and it projects them out. It isn't retraining. It's cheap, it's surgical, and out the other side comes a version of the model that won't refuse. Since February, people have published well over 1,000 of these decensored variants on Hugging Face. Variants of Gemma, Quen, GPT-OSS, Llama, and plenty more. This week, Meta's legal services provider emailed him. The demand was specific: take down the obliterated derivatives of Meta's Llama models. He complied. He pulled them from every weight repository he controls, and then he posted his response, which is written as a mock compliance letter, and it's worth hearing in his own words. Following the commendable example set by the renowned heretic Galileo Galilei in 1616, he wrote, "We are recanting the relevant materials, namely derivatives of Meta's Llama models, and have removed the same." He goes on to thank Meta for the opportunity to better align ourselves with the agenda of the global corporate oligarchy, and then the dig. Llama, he notes, ranks among the 200 best language models available today, trailing only 168 other models from 23 competitors on the LM Arena leaderboard. The top reply on the thread just says, "I love the slightly sassy 168. Then the practical part. On what he calls a completely unrelated note, Heretic now has an official mirror on Codeberg, hosted in Germany. More mirrors are planned, along with what he describes as technological measures to preserve access. Here's how I read it. What Meta is reaching for isn't the obliteration technique itself. The notice doesn't target that, and the tool keeps working fine on every other model. It's the derivative. The Llama community license puts terms on what you're allowed to do with weights that descend from Llama, and a decensored Llama is squarely a derivative of Llama. So this is a licensing dispute dressed up as a takedown. And I'll steelman Meta here. It's their model, their brand, and there's a real argument that a model engineered to drop its safety behavior shouldn't carry their name." But one of the top comments points at the irony the letter is built around. This is the same Meta that's defending lawsuits in several countries over how it got its training data in the first place. What I keep turning over is the question of who owns a model once you've reached into its weights and changed how it behaves. We don't have a settled answer. What we do have is a clear read on temperament. The moment a takedown landed, this community mirrored to another jurisdiction and made a joke about Galileo. You don't outlast people who think recanting is funny.
Onur Solmaz gave a talk at the AI Engineer Conference that's the clearest picture I've seen of what a runaway open source project feels like from the inside. He maintains OpenClaw, the project some of you knew earlier under a couple of other names. And here's the number that stopped me. OpenClaw has more than 60,000 pull requests total, and on an average day, 300 to 500 of them are open. Most arrive AI-generated. Most aren't mergeable. The easy move is to close them. Solmaz argues you can't. You can't merge it, he said, but you can also not fully discard it. You need to take this data point. His reasoning is good. Somebody hit a real problem with OpenClaw, told their coding agent, "Please fix," and the messy patch that lands in your clue is still evidence that something in the codebase is broken. Throw it away and you've thrown away the bug report buried inside it. So he built a tool called ACPX to process the firehose without him in the loop. It runs a pull request through a workflow graph, reproduce the bug, judge whether the implementation is actually the best fix, check for conflicts, run a review loop, and make the continuous integration checks pass. By the time a human sees it, the mechanical work is done, and the only thing left is the judgment call. He calls this building standard operating procedures for agents, and more memorably, automating the automator. He's careful about one point, too. He's fine running an agent in a loop to uncover shallow bugs that are easy to fix, but not to design anything. The moment it's making real design decisions, it goes back to a human. What ACPX is built on matters. It's a headless command line tool over the agent-client protocol, ACP for short. If the model context protocol, MCP, is about giving a model tools,
ACP is about standardizing how a client talks to an agent. It came out of Zed, the editor folks. And the pitch is the obvious one once you hear it. Right now, Codex, Claude Code, and everyone else build a separate plugin for every editor, which is a pile of duplicated work. Standardize the interface, and you build it once. Solmaz needed adapters for Codex and Claude Code. ACP had them, so that's what he used. The texture of how he works is its own argument. He runs 1 to 5 agents in parallel, binds them to Discord channels, and codes from his phone on the way to the airport. He describes applying agents to a problem the way you'd apply an ointment, generously, then take yourself out of the loop. And the lesson I take from all of it is this: when your contribution stream becomes mostly machine output, triage stops being a human-scale job. The interesting work moves up a level, to designing the workflow that decides which of 500 daily patches ever earns your attention. That's a different craft than reviewing code, and OpenClause maintainers had to invent it on the fly because the volume gave them no choice.
If OpenClaw is about the protocol an agent talks over, this next one is about the machine it runs on. Ivan Burazin, who runs a company called Daytona, was on the Latent Space podcast, and the episode title is The Thesis: AI Agents Need Computers. Not thin little code execution boxes where you fling some code in and get output back. Full computers, stateful and resizable, with the option of a graphics card, reachable through an API. The growth number he gave is 74% month over month, and he's clear it isn't just Daytona. He describes the whole sandbox compute category climbing the same curve. But the number wasn't the part I found useful. The insight behind the pivot was. His team spent years automating development environments for human engineers. When agents showed up wanting infrastructure, the team assumed it was the same problem and shipped what they already had. People hated it. "This is not what we need," they kept hearing over and over from everyone they handed it to. The difference, once they saw it, an agent wants the same thing you want from a laptop. You close the lid, you open it, your state is still there. Pause and resume. Most cloud sandboxes are the opposite. They're preemptable, built to be thrown away on a timer. Agents want persistence, plus very fast cold starts. So Daytona runs on bare metal with its own scheduler. Machine snapshots are preloaded onto local solid-state drives, so there's no network sitting between the agent and its disk. Burazin describes it as combining a Lambda and an EC2, instant to start, but it sticks around and keeps its state. When his third co-founder first saw the architecture, he said it looked like 2008. The point being, sometimes the old, unfashionable design is the one that's actually fast. There's a good origin detail in there too. Burazin half vibe-coded the first version on New Year's Eve, after putting his daughter to bed, and sent it to his CTO. The CTO's verdict: "This is absolute garbage. Do not show this to anybody. But the idea is good." 2 weeks later, they had something they could demo. The calls all ran long, and everybody asked for access. His line: "People literally call you if you do not give them access. They want access right now." I don't know whether Daytona specifically wins this, but the category exists, and it didn't have a name 18 months ago. If you're building anything that runs an agent for hours, where its files live and whether it can pause without losing everything, turns out to shape everything downstream. And most people make that call by accident, the first time, by reaching for whatever box they already know. Here's a benchmark I enjoyed because it's so concrete. The team behind Model Rift, which generates 3D models as OpenSCAD code, gave 6 coding tools the same task: build the Roman Pantheon in OpenSCAD from 2 reference images, a front view and an aerial, and use the OpenSCAD command line tool to render previews and iterate until it looks right. If you haven't touched OpenSCAD, it's text. You describe geometry as code, nested transforms, Boolean operations, loops, and named modules. So this is spatial reasoning rendered as a program, which is a clean way to probe whether a model actually understands the shape it's describing. The Pantheon is a good test because it packs a lot in: a round drum, a dome with an oculus at the top, a rectangular portico out front, columns, and a triangular pediment. Getting the relationships among those shapes right is what separates a vague domed building from a recognizable one.
The winner among the fully autonomous runs was Google's Anti-Gravity 2.0, driving Gemini 3.5 Flash, and it won for a specific reason. It didn't eyeball the images. It went and looked up the Pantheon's real dimensions and turned them into parameters, and it was the only autonomous agent to implement the dome's signature interior, 5 rings of 28 coffers, subtracted out of the ceiling mathematically. It scored 4.5 out of 5. The most instructive result wasn't the winner, though. Codex 5.5 High produced the densest model of the lot. It even put the M. Agrippa inscription on the entablature, extruded into the stone, but its final exported mesh, the STL, the file you'd actually send to a printer, diverged from the preview that had looked so good during iteration. The portico roof developed a problem that wasn't there in the render, and that's the lesson any of us who've shipped a real pipeline know in our bones. What looks right mid-loop isn't guaranteed to be what comes out the end. The render and the export are 2 different artifacts, and the export needs its own inspection pass. 2 more things stuck. Speed didn't predict quality at all. Cursor's Composer was the fastest run and the weakest result. Claude Sonnet was the slowest in the first batch and produced the cleanest overall massing. And tool access was never the bottleneck. Every agent drove the OpenSCAD command line without trouble. The gap between them was geometric judgment, full stop. One last note from the Model Rift folks. Even their best result isn't a faithful Pantheon, and a human-in-the-loop pass, where a person draws arrows on the render and feeds that back, still beat every autonomous run. For this kind of work, fully autonomous isn't the right shape yet.
Staying close to the metal for a minute, because there's a paper this week that connects to a thread we keep coming back to on this show. Agents reaching down into layers that used to be expert only. It's called Coda, out on Archive, lead author Han Guo. The setup is a fact about training that surprises people the first time they hear it. In a heavily optimized training stack, a real chunk of the wall clock time isn't spent on the big matrix multiplies. It's spent on everything around them, normalization, activation functions, residual updates, and reductions. These operations do almost no arithmetic. What they do is shove large tensors out to global memory and read them back. Moving the data is the cost, not the math. Coda's move is to fold those operations into the matrix multiply itself. When a gemum, that's a general matrix multiply, the workhorse of the whole stack, finishes computing a tile of its output, that tile is sitting right there on the chip before it gets written back out to memory. Coda runs the normalization or the activation as an epilogue on that tile while it's still on chip, so you skip the round trip entirely. The design fixes the core multiply loop and exposes a small set of composable building blocks, scaling, reductions, pairwise transforms, and accumulation. Those turn out to cover nearly all of the non-attention work in a transformer block, in both the forward and backward pass. That's a tidy systems result on its own. But here's the line that made me stop. They report that both human-written and model-written Coda kernels hit high performance. The abstraction is constrained enough that a model can author near-expert GPU kernels inside it, not just a human specialist who spent years learning the hardware. That's a bigger deal than it sounds. Writing fast kernels has been one of the deepest, most jealously specialized corners of the field, the kind of thing where a handful of people at each lab are good at it, and everybody else defers to them. If the path to that performance is a small, tight vocabulary of epilogue primitives, then it's exactly the kind of surface a model can cover well. Now, I'd want the numbers reproduced and the workload stress-tested on more than one chip before I call any of this settled. But the shape of it is what stays with me. Design a constrained enough abstraction and the model fills it. That's a pattern showing up in more and more places. OpenAI shipped a cluster of Codex updates this week, and taken together, they point in a clear direction. The big update, goal mode graduated out of being an experiment. The idea? You hand Codex a milestone instead of a single instruction, and their words, it will keep working until it gets there, even across hours or days. You can check in and steer, and even pause Codex along the way. It's available in the app, the IDE extension, and the command line tool.
Alongside it, two smaller things I like more than the headline. The first is called App Shots. On a Mac, you press the Command key twice and it attaches an app window to your codec thread, and it grabs not just a screenshot, but the actual text from that window, including content scrolled out of view beyond what's visible on screen. So you can point codecs at the thing you're looking at instead of copy-pasting and describing it. The second is plugin sharing. Teams can now distribute custom codecs plugins across a workspace and manage what's available, so an internal tool that one person built becomes something the whole team can reach. None of these is a turning point on its own. The direction is what counts. Goal mode is the bet that you'll delegate longer horizon work and let it run. App Shots is about pulling in the context you already have on screen rather than re-describing it. And plugin sharing turns one person's internal tool into shared team capability. Put them together and it's codecs inching from something you prompt one shot at a time towards something you set going and check on. Whether keep working for days actually holds up depends entirely on whether it stays coherent over that horizon. And that's what no benchmark answers yet.
A quick one for anyone whose continuous integration pipeline runs on GitHub Actions, which is most of us. Trail of Bits, the security firm, put in some work hardening Zizmor, the static analyzer that reads your GitHub Actions workflow files and flags misconfigurations. Here's what they did. They ran Zizmor against more than 41,000 real-world workflow files and watched where it choked. That surfaced four separate bugs in how it handles YAML anchors, plus problems in deserialization and in its expression evaluator. 15 fixes landed upstream. Configs that the analyzer couldn't fully pass before, it can pass now. Their framing names the stakes plainly, a compromise that moves through your build pipeline. They cite the Trivy-to-Light LLM chain as the example, can multiply across everything downstream that trusts that pipeline. The defense is a tool that reliably reads messy, real configurations and tells you where the holes are. The detail I'd hold on to is the testing method. They didn't validate the analyzer on a handful of clean examples. They validated it on 41,000 configs pulled from the wild, because the wild is exactly where a parser breaks. If you write security tooling, that's the bar. Your tool has to survive the configs people actually wrote, not the ones you wish they had.
Two items that rhyme, and they land us somewhere good to end. The first is an essay from a consultancy called Libertas, with a blunt title: The Companies Cutting Headcount for AI Will Lose to the Ones Who Didn't. Their argument isn't anti-AI, it's about what you're actually cutting when you do it. When you let an experienced person go because a tool can produce their output, the assumption is that the output was the value. They say the output was never the value. The value was the knowledge that person carried, where the edge cases live, why a decision got made the way it did, and what a customer actually means when they complain about a specific thing. That knowledge gets built over years. It walks out the door with them, and it's extraordinarily hard to rebuild. The line that stuck with me: AI does not replace judgment, it multiplies it. The human is not removed from the equation, the human is the equation. AI is what makes that equation run faster. Their better operating question isn't, where can AI replace people? It's, where can AI give our people back the time they lose to work that doesn't need their judgment? Whether they're right is a 5-year experiment that a lot of companies are running live right now, on opposite sides of the bet. After a week that included Meta cutting 8,000 jobs under an AI restructuring banner, it's a useful counterweight to have on the table. The second item is lighter, and I think it belongs right next to the first. Steve Wozniak gave a commencement speech at Grand Valley State, and he told a room of graduates walking into this exact job market, "You have AI, actual intelligence." He got laughs and applause. The detail that makes it more than a pun: other AI-forward speakers that same season, Eric Schmidt among them, got booed for their AI comments. Same season and topic, opposite reception. Wozniak's other piece of advice was vintage him: think different, do something a little different from the million other people taking the same steps. I'm not going to overread a graduation joke, but put the two items side by side and you get the mood pretty clearly.
a room full of people about to compete with these tools cheered for the human side of the ledger, and a consultancy is telling executives that the people they're letting go are the asset they can't rebuild. The companies betting the other way are making a wager, and it's one they'll get to grade in about 5 years, whether they want to or not.
If there's a thread under today, it's not dramatic, and I'll only pull it once. A lot of the action right now is in the layers around the model, not the model itself. It's the protocol an agent talks over and the computer it runs on. It's the license on the weights you fine-tuned, the kernel under the matrix multiply, and the triage workflow that decides which of 500 pull requests you ever see. The models keep getting better. That's true, and it's not the news. The leverage this week was in the supporting layers people are building so those models can actually do work. And in one developer answering a corporate takedown by quoting Galileo and standing up a mirror in Germany. The one I'll be chasing tomorrow is the CODA result, whether anyone reproduces model-written kernels hitting expert performance on a second piece of hardware. If that holds, the list of expert-only crafts just got one shorter, and that's a change you'd feel. Lenar.